When you go to the doctor for medical treatment, at the very least, you hope that their interest is to make you better. Not so in the case of Harold Shipman, a practicing English general practitioner who was behind at least 15 deaths of patients under his care. What drove him to such depravity and death? That's what we ask today on The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Harold Frederick Shipman, known to acquaintances as Fred Shipman, was an English general practitioner who's believed to be one of the most prolific serial killers in modern history. On the 31st of January 2000, he was found guilty of the murder of 15 patients under his care. His total number of victims was approximately 250. Shipman was sentenced to life imprisonment with the recommendation that he never be released. He died by suicide, hanging himself in his cell at HM Prison, Wakefield, West Yorkshire, on the 13th of January, 2004, a day before his 58th birthday. The Shipman Inquiry, a two-year-long investigation of all deaths certified by Shipman, which Dame Janet Smith chaired, examined Shipman's crimes. The inquiry identified 218 victims and estimated his total victim count at 250, about 80% of whom were elderly women. Shipman's youngest confirmed victim was a 41-year-old man, although suspicion arose that he had killed patients as young as four. He's the only British doctor to have been found guilty of murdering his patients, although other doctors have been acquitted of similar crimes or convicted on lesser charges. So here we go, Dark Side of Wikipedia. This sounds like a lovely individual here. If you like our program, please become a Dark Sider. Get all the bonus content, all the advanced episodes, the final chapters. Do that over at patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia, or go to our website, darksideofwiki.com, and click Become a Dark Sider. Help keep us on the air. Press subscribe wherever you download the podcasts. It's Tony and Sean with you today. It's kind of amazing that someone can get away with that many deaths under their belt. I mean, I get you're a doctor. You're going to come in contact with death a lot more frequently than, Vic from Vic's Breaks and More. But 250 in a kind of condensed period of time, is that not a high number?
You know, I'd say that's above the average there, Tony. People get into the medical field for many reasons, to save lives, to cure childhood cancer, to be a very specialized specialist in some care, to assist or to kill people.
I'm guessing that's not, I mean, what happens, I mean, what I'd love to do, honestly, is go back to like high school days where they would have us fill out those things on computers where it was like, put your interests in, answer these questions, and then it tells you what your suggested career path should be. I'd love to just do it in a very tongue-in-cheek, screwed-up sort of way and see where it suggests you go if all the answers you filled out really kind of go along hand-in-hand with like a sociopath of something.
And to have some teacher or some yearbook director in the middle of the yearbook, most likely to be a serial killer, most likely to throw babies in a trunk, most likely to publicly expose themselves at Target.
Yeah, I think those should be things that are now put in the yearbooks rather than just most likely to succeed. Like, no, let's get a little more detailed here, because this is more likely of what's going to happen in life than succeed or do this. Like, let's get really specific. Most likely to go through medical school and eventually kill 250 people. I guess that's the thing. I mean, to become a doctor is not an easy task. And once you get there, what the hell?
I mean, what's very interesting is if you were to talk to some of Old Harold's teachers back in his early youth, I would imagine they would say he had perseverance. As you said, getting through medical school only to be able to become a doctor. Not a lot of people do it because it is insanely difficult. You have to be persistent. You have to be intelligent. You have to, I mean, so many things just to be able to put on the white coat. And then for it to go to this, what I'm excited to find out is this something that spurred from his early childhood that he ultimately took a diversion or some type of release on killing people, or this only became recent day when he was already in the medical profession and it went from a very good place of being a doctor to the opposite of.
A very dark place of being a doctor. Let's jump into more of his backstory and his history and learn a little bit more about Harold Frederick Shipman. He was born on the 14th of January, 1946, on the Bestwood Council Estate in Nottinghamshire, England. Second of three children of Harold Frederick Shipman, a truck driver, and Vera Britton. His working-class parents were devout Methodists. When growing up, Shipman was an accomplished rugby player in youth leagues. Shipman passed his 11-plus in 1957, moving to High Pavement Grammar School, Nottingham, which he left in 1964. He excelled as a distance runner and in his final year at school served a vice-captain role of the athletic team. Shipman was particularly close to his mother, who died of lung cancer when he was age 17. Her death came in a manner similar to what later became Shipman's own modus operandi. In later stages of her disease, she had morphine administered at home by a doctor. Shipman witnessed his mother's pain subside despite her terminal condition until her death on the 21st of June, 1963. On the 5th of November, 1966, he married Primrose May Oxtoby. The couple had four children. Shipman studied medicine at Leeds School of Medicine, University of Leeds, graduating in 1970. He began working at Pontefract General Infirmary in Pontefract West Riding of Yorkshire, and in 1974 took his first position as a general practitioner at the Abraham Umarad Medical Center in Todmorden. In the following year, Shipman was caught forging prescriptions of Demerol for his own use. He was fined $600 and briefly attended a drug rehabilitation clinic in York. He became a GP at the Donnybrook Medical Center in Hyde near Manchester in 1977. Shipman continued working as a GP in Hyde throughout the 1980s and established his own surgery at 21 Market Street in 1993, becoming a respected member of the community. In 1983, he was interviewed in an edition of the Granada television documentary World in Action on how the mentally ill should be treated in the community. A year after his conviction, the interview was rebroadcast on Tonight with Trevor MacDonald. In March of 1998, Dr. Linda Reynolds of the Brook Surgery in Hyde expressed concerns to John Fullard, the coroner of the South Manchester District, about the high death rate among Shipman's patients. In particular, she was concerned about the large number of cremation forms for elderly women that he had needed countersigned. Police were unable to find sufficient evidence to bring charges and close the investigation on the 17th of April. The Shipman inquiry later blamed the Greater Manchester Police for assigning inexperienced officers to the case. After the investigation was closed, Shipman killed three more people. In August, taxi driver John Shaw told the police that he suspected Shipman of murdering 21 patients. Shaw became suspicious as many of the elderly customers he took to the hospital, who seemed to be in good health, died in Shipman's care. Shipman's last victim was Kathleen Grundy, who was found dead at her home on the 24th of June, 1998. It was the last person to see her alive. He later signed her death certificate, recording the cause of death as old age. Grundy's daughter, lawyer Angela Woodruff, became concerned when solicitor Brian Burgess informed her that a will had been made, apparently by her mother, with doubts about its authenticity. The will excluded Woodruff and her children, but left $386,000 to Shipman. And Burgess, urging Woodruff, went to the police, who began an investigation. Grundy's body was exhumed and found to contain traces of heroin, often used for pain control in terminal cancer patients. Shipman claimed that Grundy had been an addict and showed them comments he had written to that effect in his computerized medical journal. However, examination of his computer showed that they were written after her death. Shipman was arrested on the 7th of September, 1998, and was found to own a Brother typewriter, the kind used to make the forged will. Prescription for Murder, a 2000 book by journalist Brian Whittle and Gene Ritchie, suggested that Shipman forged the will either because he wanted to be caught, because his life was out of control, or because he planned to retire at 55 and then leave the UK. The police investigated other deaths Shipman had certified and investigated 15 specimen cases. They discovered a pattern of his administering lethal doses of diopramine, signing patients' death certificates, and then falsifying medical records to indicate that they had been in poor health. So this guy, I would certainly, it would be a red flag if suddenly your parent dies and you're not in the will, but somehow the doctor that she died underneath is like the head of the will and gets mostly everything. That's usually not how wills work.
So we found out that is this something that stemmed from Harold's early childhood or something that transpired in professional life? It was the latter. Yeah, this is absolutely something not normal whatsoever. And is it a coincidence that he also happens to be a doctor and this doctor got a crap ton of money? If somebody dies and I benefit from it in receiving a lot of money, I would absolutely consider, how did she die? I know it was my mom, but what elixir that allowed her to die? Maybe I'll do that and make the checking account balance a little bit higher.
It's just so scary and weird, though. I mean, I'm looking at this, like as you had said earlier, saying, is this a product of, his childhood? Did something happen there? Or I don't know. I mean, who goes through medical school all that ways with the idea that you're going to make obvious blunders like this? But the thing is, he got away with it for so long without, I guess, getting a lot of money. But maybe there was a lot more. Maybe it was kind of building up to that amount of money. Maybe there was like smaller amounts and smaller amounts, because that's how a lot of financial crimes work, where somebody gets away with something smaller, and or any crime really. Someone steals a pack of gum, it's the gateway gum, and then it raises up to a magazine, and then it raises out to maybe a purse, and then it raises up to maybe a bunch of clothes, and then it raises up to God knows what, holding up the whole fucking store and emptying the cash register. But, people, it's usually kind of a progression of things. So you have to kind of wonder, did this start really small? And then it just got to the point where $300,000 wasn't that big of a deal to him in his mind. But to everyone else on the planet, they're like, what the fuck are you doing? I don't know. I mean, my other question to this is, and I wonder if it's ever been looked into, he was a rugby player for quite some time. That can be a fairly violent sport. And you could get injured in the head fairly easily. So I'm almost wondering if there was any sort of, long-term brain damage that was done that kind of fucked with something in terms of his reasoning and, just sense of what's okay, what's not okay, and all that, that played a role in him doing what he ended up doing later in life.
I think you can have a very clear thought, and should that be altered just in the slightest, aka a tackle in rugby or hitting your noggin on the field goal post,
yeah,
that then just goes off. And similar to your point of financial crimes, they start at this and they grow. $300,000, which is holy fuck ton of money to some. If he's thinking multiple millions of dollars, this $300,000 is like a $20 bill.
Yeah.
So it is the medical field, and as a doctor, I would imagine clearly as patients, we have a certain level of knowledge and expectation, but being on the other side of that desk, being the MD, I would imagine there's an absolute shit ton of minutia and stuff you go through And if you can benefit and there is a financial gain, it's a slippery slope of those that stay the course and be good medical professionals. Mm-hmm. And then there's Harold.
Well, I mean, it takes, you have to be very intelligent to become a doctor. And with that intelligence, like anything, it can be used for good. It can be used for bad. And I think he went down the path of, I'm going to use this for bad because I'm smarter than most other people and I can outsmart them. Clearly, he was able to do that for more than 250 deaths. But I mean, you got to look at that. I mean, I have a lot of friends. I have a lot of people who I've worked with over the years making commercials that were doctors. And, you know, they're their own kind of breed of people in many cases. And I'm not saying that in a bad way. It's just when you, I think, are at a certain level of intelligence, it's hard to relate to a lot of others. And that's what I have found with a lot of them. A lot of them, in fact, I can't say I've really run across any in my life that I've thought were bad, evil people or anything like that. Some that were a little more quiet than others. And I think that kind of comes with the territory of high intelligence. Sometimes you just get more quiet because you don't necessarily feel a lot can relate to you. And then you can kind of come across as pompous, even though that's not what you're meaning to do. You're just kind of more reserved because it's hard for you to relate to others. And then sometimes I think that can be taken as, well, there's something weird with that person. No, I think it's just with such a high level of intelligence, it can be used, like I said, for uber good or uber bad. But when you're that high in the intelligence department, it's going to be one extreme or the other. There's not going to be a lot of middle or average going on here. You're not going to be an average killer. You're not going to be just kind of an average this or that. You're either going to be all in there or all in that way. And I think we found Harold going all in the wrong direction. Let's continue in with the story. In 2003, David Spielhalter suggested that statistical monitoring could have led to an alarm being raised at the end of 1996 when there are 67 excess deaths in females aged 65 years and older, compared to 119 by 1998. Shipman's trial began at Preston Crown Courts on the 5th of October, 1999. He was charged with the murders of 15 women by lethal injections of diamorphine, all between 1995 and 1998. Shipman's legal representatives tried unsuccessfully to have the Grundy case tried separately from the others, as a motive was shown by the alleged forgery of Grundy's will. On the 31st of January 2000, after 6 days of deliberation, the jury found Shipman guilty of 15 counts of murder and one count of forgery. Mr. Justice Forbes subsequently sentenced Shipman to life imprisonment on all 15 counts of murder, with a recommendation that he never be released to be served concurrently with a sentence of 4 years for forging Grundy's will. On the 11th of February, 10 days after his conviction, Shipman was struck off by the General Medical Council. 2 years later, Home Secretary David Blunkett confirmed the judge's whole life tariff, just months before British government ministers lost their power to set minimum terms for prisoners. While authorities could have brought many additional charges, they concluded that a fair hearing would be impossible in view of the enormous publicity surrounding the original trial. Furthermore, the 15 life sentences already handed down rendered further litigation unnecessary. Shipman became friends with fellow serial killer Peter Moore while incarcerated. Shipman consistently denied his guilt, disputing the scientific evidence against him. He never made any public statements about his actions. Shipman's wife, Primrose, steadfastly maintained her husband's innocence even after his conviction. Shipman is the only doctor in the history of British medicine found guilty of murdering his patients. John Bodkin Adams was charged in 1957 with murdering a patient amid rumors he had killed dozens more over a 10-year period and possibly provided the role model for Shipman. However, he was acquitted. Historian Pamela Cullen has argued that because of Adams' acquittal, there was no impetus to examine the flaws in the British legal system until the Shipman case. Shipman hung himself in his cell at HM Prison Wakefield at 6:20 a.m. on the 13th of January 2004, the eve of his 58th birthday, and was pronounced dead at 8:10 a.m. A statement from Her Majesty's Prison Service indicated that he had hung himself from the window bars of his cell using bed sheets. After Shipman's death, his body was taken to the mortuary at the Medical Legal Center for post-mortem examination. West Yorkshire coroner David Hinecliffe eventually released the body to the family after an inquest was opened and adjourned shortly after. Some of the victims' families said they felt cheated, as Shipman's suicide meant they would never have the satisfaction of his confession, nor answers as to why he committed his crimes. Home Secretary David Blunkett said celebration was tempting. You wake up and you receive a call telling you Shipman has topped himself, and you think, is it too early to open a bottle? And then you discover that everybody's very upset that he's done it. Shipman's death divided national newspapers, with the Daily Mirror branding him a cold coward and condemning the prison service for allowing his suicide to happen. However, the Sun ran a celebratory front page headline, Ship Ship Hooray! The Independent called for the inquiry into Shipman's suicide to look more widely at the state of UK prisons, as well as the welfare of inmates. In The Guardian, an article, General Sir David Ramsbottomham, who had formerly served as Her Majesty's Chief Inspector of Prisons, suggested that whole life sentencing be replaced by indefinite sentencing, for this would at least give prisoners the hope of eventual release and reduce their risk of their ending their own lives by suicide, as well as making their management easier for prison officials. Shipman's motive for suicide was never established, though he reportedly told his probation officer that he was considering suicide to assure his wife's financial security after he was stripped of his National Health Service pension. Primrose Shipman received a full NHS pension. She would not have been entitled to it if Shipman had lived past 60. Additionally, there was evidence that Primrose, who had consistently protested Shipman's innocence despite the overwhelming evidence, had begun to suspect his guilt. Shipman refused to take part in courses which would have encouraged acknowledgement of his crimes, leading to a temporary removal of privileges, including the opportunity to telephone his wife. During this period, according to Shipman's cellmate, he received a letter from Primrose exonerating him to tell me everything, no matter what. A 2005 inquiry found that Shipman's suicide could not have been predicted or prevented, but that procedures should nonetheless be re-examined. After Shipman's body was released to the family, it remained in Sheffield for more than a year despite multiple false reports about his funeral. His widow was advised by police against burying her husband in case the grave was attacked. Shipman was eventually cremated on the 19th of March 2005 at Huckcliffe Wood Crematorium. The cremation took place outside normal hours to maintain secrecy and was attended only by Primrose and their four children. In January of 2001, Chris Gregg, a senior West Yorkshire police detective, was selected to lead the investigation into 22 of West Yorkshire's deaths. Following this, the Shipman inquiry, submitted in July of 2002, concluded that he had killed at least 218 of his patients between 1975 and 1998, during which time he practiced in Tonmodern and Hyde. Dame Janet Smith, the judge who submitted the report, admitted that many more deaths of a suspicious nature could not be definitively ascribed to Shipman. Most of his victims were elderly women in good health. In her sixth and final report issued on the 24th of January 2005, Smith reported that she believed that Shipman had killed three patients, and she had serious suspicions about four further deaths, including that of a four-year-old girl during the early stages of his medical career at Pontefract General Infirmary. In total, 459 people died while under his care between 71 and 98. But it's uncertain how many of those were murder victims, as he was often the only doctor to certify a death. Smith's estimate of Shipman's total victims count over that 27-year period was 250. The GMC charged six doctors who signed cremation forms for Shipman's victims with misconduct, claiming they should have noticed the pattern between Shipman's home visits and his patients' deaths. All these doctors are found not guilty. In October of 2005, a similar hearing was held against two doctors who worked at Tamminside General Hospital in 1994, who failed to detect that Shipman had deliberately administered a grossly excessive dose of morphine. The Shipman inquiry recommended changes to the structure of GMC. In 2005, it came to light that Shipman may have stolen jewelry from his victims. In 1998, police had seized over $10,000 worth of jewelry they found in his garage. In March of 2005, when Primrose asked for its return, police wrote to the families of Shipman's victims, asking them to identify the jewelry. Unidentified items were handed to the Assets Recovery Agency in May. The investigation ended in August. Authorities returned 66 pieces to Primrose and auctioned 33 pieces that she confirmed were not hers. Proceeds of the auction went to Tamside Victim Support. The only piece returned to a murdered patient's family was a platinum diamond ring for which the family provided a photograph as proof of ownership. A memorial garden to Shipman's victims called the Gardens of Tranquility opened in Hyde Park, Hyde on the 30th of July, 05. As of early 2009, families of over 200 of the victims of Shipman were still seeking compensation for the loss of their relatives. In September of 09, authorities announced that letters Shipman wrote in prison would be sold at auction, but following complaints from victims' relatives and the media, they withdrew the letters from the sale. And then there's the Shipman effect. The Shipman case and a series of recommendations in the Shipman Inquiry Report led to challenges and changes to standard medical procedures in the UK, now referred to as the Shipman effect. Many doctors reported changes in their dispensing practices and a reluctance to risk overprescribing pain medication may have led to underprescribing. Death certification practices were altered as well. Perhaps the largest change was the movement from single doctor general practices to multiple doctor general practices. This was not a direct recommendation, but rather because the report stated that there was not enough safeguarding and monitoring of doctors' decisions. The forms needed for a cremation in England and Wales have had their questions altered as a direct result of the Shipman case. For example, the persons organizing the funeral must answer, "Do you know or suspect that the death of the person who has died was violent or unnatural? Do you consider that there should be any further examination of the remains of the person who has died?" Well, I bet it'd be a nice day to go take a picnic over at the Memorial Gardens for the 250 people that he took out. I can't imagine. Yeah. Nice thought. And I guess maybe to the victims it's good. I don't know. I mean, if my family or someone that I knew was killed by this guy, I don't know that I would really, I don't know. Would you go hang out in the memorial garden of like all of the, you know, because it's not like just a memorial garden for one person. It's like for everybody. I think it would just make me more angry.
I would concur in that statement. That is, I think it's very difficult to view what you would do if not put in that position. Your headspace is so utterly confused. Yeah. You're dealing with death, then you're dealing with a person that is specifically involved in said death, but he's a doctor, so then you have conflicting messages of, but I don't understand how somebody that is supposed to do so much good can not. So I think it's clear as mud in a situation of what I would do. I would go back to what you say in prior episodes. If somebody knowingly caused harm to a loved one, I would want to meet him in a parking lot in the back of a bar after we've had a few Miller High Lifes.
Yeah, I mean, it's everybody grieves differently. And, you know, some people, that's a real peaceful thing to do. I mean, as much as I like cemeteries, you know what I don't like to do? Visit my dead relatives at them. And that's just me. I mean, for some, they get relief there that's helpful and great. I for me, I don't like that. And it's not like I feel like I'm disrespecting anything. I just feel like they're not there. I don't feel closer to them by going to a gravesite. Now, I have grandparents who have passed and all that, but I've never experienced someone directly close to me, like a mother or father or anything like that, pass in my life yet. So that opinion could change at some point in time. I don't know. But as of right now, that's just kind of how I feel. But that's me.
I can respect and see where you're coming from. Personally, I too, mom and dad, still on earth and living as at the time of this recording. But grandparents growing up, I can remember going more so with my mom to see her grandparents, my grandpa with my dad. And I can see the comfort and the, it's not so much grieving, but just on, for example, on my grandpa's birthday, there was a couple of years growing up that my dad and I would go see him at the cemetery. He's in a mausoleum. I also can totally respect and see the weirdness and not feeling any closer, but I think for me, that's just going to be a decision that I will make upon having someone a little bit closer to me, i.e. a parent, and then probably go visit them soon after. And then whatever vibe I feel then will the decision I make moving forward.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I am interested to hear more about the wife, what happened to her. And I am kind of shocked that she got the pension after he was, you know, found to have, you know, killed all those people, that they still said, yeah, you can get the pension. I would think that might be a little if anything's disqualifying, that might be it. Now, I know she wasn't necessarily the one behind the deaths, but still, you're pretty fucking connected. And that may impact your benefits. But in our final chapter over on Patreon, we're going to jump into whatever happened to Harold Shipman's wife, Primrose Shipman. You want to find that out, become a Darksider, sign up to become one over on our Patreon page, patreon.com/darkside of Wikipedia. Go to our website, Darkside of Wiki, and click Become a Darksider. $5 a month gets you access to all of our final chapters, all of our advanced episodes, so you can continue binging away on the dark side of Wikipedia. Sean and myself will see you over there, patreon.com/darkside of Wikipedia.